Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Meta. I'm your host, Jay Larson, and joining me this week, I have a very special guest, one William Hungerford.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Will?
Busy. There's so much going on right now.
Yeah, I feel you.
It's 2020.
So, for those who have been living under a rock, who are you?
I am the lead developer at Privateer Press. I've been here for, actually in 3 days, so January 10th, because we're recording this on the 7th, is my 10-year anniversary working at Privateer Press. So I've been here for a decade, whereas I started, you know, running the press gang back in the day and then doing organized play, which I still do all the organized play, but more solely focused on that. I've slowly made my way up in the company, and now I'm lead dev, which means I work on a variety of games.
So my understanding is that you are currently God Emperor of War Machine. Is that correct?
I am. Of my development duties, the two that definitely have my top priority is War Machine and Hordes, which I'm lead dev of recently. I actually took over basically during the Convergence CID.
Yeah, I think that this is probably a bit of news that a lot of people aren't aware of, but until that Convergence CID, the lead developer for War Machine was Jason Souls. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I mean, it's still a collaborative effort. It's just
sure, yeah.
The lead
it's not like it's not like anyone has put a ball gag in Jason and said that he can't contribute. It's just...
Correct. Yeah, it's whoever is basically running the ship at the time and making sure that things are getting done and contributing. Also, you know, it has a lot of creative opportunity. A lot of models coming up were pitches that I was able to make. And, you know, previously a lot of those would have come from Jason and Matt. So I was able to pitch these directly to Matt. And I think part of that opportunity I've been given is because prior to that, I've been, since day one, lead dev and design on Riot Quest.
Right.
And a big part of doing Riot Quest is not only developing that game, but also designing and writing all the War Machine rules for those models, which I had been doing. And then most of the Riot Quest models are pitches that have come from me to Matt that Matt's approved. So when the time came to then do the same for new War Machine Hordes models, it was sort of a smooth transition and kind of how I ended up being lead on two separate games at the same time.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see the future of both games.
It is an interesting switch because your brain has to flip between the Saturday morning cartoon whimsy of Riot Quest to the serious, you know, Infernals are here. Let's dive into the more, I want to say realistic, even though it's a, you know, fantasy setting, but compared to Riot Quest, more realistic side that is War Machine and Hordes, and kind of flipping that switch creatively in your brain has been a fun exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll go ahead and go over real quick the format of the podcast, and then we'll dive right into things.
Yeah, I've never been. This is my first time.
Yeah, well, it'll be a magical experience.
I mean, normally you and I are on Chain Attack with, you know, Josh and Trevor. So I don't have you, you know, Josh being the wonderful warm human being he is, and Trevor being the wonderful warm human being he is. And I feel like this is more intimate. This is like when you and I do commentary, minus dank Dune memes, which I was promised there would be none of.
Oh, there was no promise of that given, because there, I did feel like we had to have a little crossover. And so that is prepped in the hopper, ready to go.
I thought I was safe this one time.
No.
This is like okay. When Paul Rudd goes on Conan and shows the same clip every time. Sorry, go ahead.
So we'll be about 45 or 50 minutes in this first episode, and we'll have a bunch of Patreon backer questions that we'll be pitching to you. And then we'll continue the conversation in our second episode, our bonus episode, that Patreon backers can listen to, and it'll also be around 45 or 50 minutes.
Okay. And
we'll continue the Patreon questions, and then if there's any, if we run out, then you'll start getting questions from me.
Oh, I'm on both episodes. I'm on the regular and the bonus one?
Yep.
Oh, let's do this.
Okay, so let's start off with, really, there's no better way to start a podcast than with a Dank Dune meme.
Why off the gate? Why is the tone like this?
So this is a Gordon Ramsay meme. The meme of him yelling at one of the people on his reality TV show. Mm-hmm. And the captioning says, "This dish is so full of spice, House Harkonnen has established mining operations." So there you go. A little love, a little Dune.
Can we never do it again?
No, absolutely not. I am, all kidding aside, do you have any excitement level for the Dune movie coming out this year?
Trepidatious excitement, just like any time they remake anything, you know, because the originals are always good. You know what so just before we get into anything that people are actually listening for, just to keep kind of going off topic, you ever seen Jacob's Ladder?
No.
Jacob's Ladder is one of my favorite movies of all time with Tim Robinson, and it's just a great, you know, inspired a lot of what Silent Hill became. Great psychological horror thriller drama movie. Brilliant. They remade it in 2019. Okay. And I don't even think it went to theaters because I just saw it on Netflix. And okay. I had a flash of anger. You ever see something like there's a movie so perfect, you're like, why? Why would you remake this? It doesn't need to be remade. So I'm going to watch it. And I feel like I'm just being terribly biased because I love the first one so much. It's like, how could a remake ever live up to it? But I'm going to give it a fair shake. And I think that's where I'm at with the Dune new movie. It's like, I'm going to give it a fair shake. Let's see what happens. You know, technology and special effects have come a long way since the original movie. So I'm trepidatiously excited.
I'm also, so the director who's making it, I'm not sure if you're aware who's connected with it, but
not sure right now.
He's the director who also made Arrival, and he made Blade Runner 2049.
Okay. Okay.
And so that has me excited.
Okay. No, that's interesting. I did not see Arrival, but I did see the new Blade Runner, and I enjoyed it.
Well, you need to rectify that because Arrival's amazing.
Well, we'll both be at LVO soon, so we can figure it out. You know what we should do for this whole show? Like, just no questions from the Patreons. Let's just talk about movies the whole time.
I don't see any way that this plant can go poorly.
No one will complain.
Speaking, I can't even think of the name of the movie, so this is getting even better. But you'll know it. I think it's Flatliners. I think is the name. So
yeah, Flatliners was a great movie.
Yeah, when you talked about movies that got remade, that you're like, why did this get remade?
Oh, Flatliners, right? Why did they remake that?
I can't answer that. Anyway,
yeah,
let us dive into the questions.
I'm ready.
Oh, I know you are. So our first question comes from this is going to be Dr. Glenn. He says, what's your overall vision for Riot Quest? Do you feel like Riot Quest is doing what you want it to?
Oh, that's a big question. So overall vision for Riot Quest is let's start with, we've got some long ranging plans for the game that are going to go on for a while. And in the Facebook group recently, I actually talked about the block format, how from every Gen Con to Gen Con would be a new Riot Quest block. And what that means is there's a new starter. That starter has a new crew. And then everything from that starter until the next starter, all the new heroes, the new maps, the new expansions are all based around a specific theme. So this first theme was the Mayhem theme, which was sort of just a little bit of everything. It was a little taste of everything. But the next one starting Gen Con this year, 2020, is the Wintertime Wasteland. It's going to be up in Kador and Rule and around where Legion used to be. And it's very like winter nuclear fallout themed. And we're going to do different blocks like this. And part of that is the idea of standard and legacy is built into the game from its bones. Because eventually, 3 years from now, approaching Riot Quest would be could be difficult because there'd be so much for it. Definitely want to have, and for retailers to carry, you know, that'd be a huge line. So we do want to have sort of the legacy version, which we'll call Mayhem, which is you can play with anything you want, and then standard, which is the most recent block or two. We're still working out some of the kinks there. So the vision for the game is, you know, it's very heavily inspired by games like Overwatch or other MOBAs like League of Legends or just fighting games in general, where you have this cast of heroes. Every hero should feel like full of flavor and their own unique play style. And, you know, even though the game is very easy to pick up and play and every hero only has three rules, there's a lot you can do with three rules in a game like this. So the idea is to keep adding these thematic blocks and make each one have its own feel. So that like one day, 5 years from now, people would be like, ah, remember playing in the Wintertime Wasteland block and like talking about their favorite combos from back in the day and just support it like that. But also the design bones of the game are built specifically. There's a lot we can add on to it. You know, like co-op modes and new types of maps that change the game in very drastic ways. It's very open in terms of design space. And is it doing what we want it to be doing right now? Yes, because it's growing in popularity constantly. More and more people are playing it, and the response from everybody who sits down and plays it is like 95% positive. Like almost everybody likes it. We're seeing it sell through more and more and more and more, where stuff's selling out and people are, you know, waiting for restocks, which are, you know, being sent out as soon as they can get there. So it's measurably successful. I'm just excited to see when people get their hands on some of the new and crazier stuff we're going to add to the game later down the road. One thing I'll say is, you know, a big draw in the beginning is that most of the models work for War Machine and Hordes. And going forward, a lot of the models will work for War Machine and Hordes. But it won't always be that way. You know, sometimes we might do thematic blocks that are so weird that the models that are in that block might not even really translate well to War Machine and Hordes, in which case we won't do it. But by that time, I think, you know, RideQuest has enough of its own gathering and its own community that it's not going to lose a lot of value if that happened.
Okay, so his follow-up question with it,
yes,
is, of the models we know of, mm-hmm, who is your top three favorites?
Captain Crawtooth, Chuck Dogwood, and Flugwug.
And why are those your favorites?
Flugwug and Captain Crawtooth because I'm biased towards blind water things. And Chuck Dogwood because of, you know, just how that character got birthed out of Twitch chat and the live streaming that was happening during some battle reports, and just sort of grew into this weird, goofy joke idea. And Riot Quest being cartoony, sort of satire, you know, in its own way, it was fun to see this thing that sort of organically grew into a character off, you know, some just random remarks, now as a model that's, you know, based off. We would see people talking in Twitch chat about hashtag Chuck Dogwood, and Chuck Dogwood did it, and all this other stuff, ever since the first couple of times he was mentioned, years before he became a model. And so seeing that become reality is just, it tickles me. And I think the people that really buy into the Saturday morning apocalypse feel of Riot Quest really appreciate some of the more goofy and whimsical models, and he's definitely one of them.
All right. Well, our next question is going to be from Hybrid Monkey D. He says, a question's for...
Hold on one second. Did you say Hybrid Monkey D?
Yes.
Okay, go on.
Yeah. A question for both Hungerford and Loremaster Larson. Mm-hmm. What are the Defiers up to during this whole infernal invasion thing?
Well, I can't give too much away about exactly what they're up to. The Grimkin, you know, were brought in originally to stave off the infernal invasion. That's why the Old Witch opened the gate and brought them out of Urkane. The idea being that they were sort of chemotherapy against the cancer that is the infernals. That, you know, the infernals have come for souls, and the Grimkin also feed off the souls of the wicked. And that if the Grimkin showed up and started the harvest, which they did, that it would disrupt the infernals' plans in a massive way, which it did. But what it did is it sped things up. You know, the Infernals weren't necessarily ready to come to Kane when they have. They had to sort of out of necessity because of what the Grimkin were doing. So the Grimkin right now are still kind of just doing what they're doing. And them and the Infernals are, you know, they're both after the same prize. It's like two gold prospectors and there's one big gold nugget in the river and they're both fighting over it. It's just the Infernals are a much more visible problem. Like gateways are opening and they're flooding and you know, people know they're there and you're getting all these strange alliances between nations and people. You know, look at what's happening with Asphyxius 4 and Nemo 4, for example, where people are like, we have to deal with the Infernals. There was no sort of response like that to the Grimkin. And I think it's because the Grimkin are more like folklore. They're more hidden in the woods and spoken in legends and myth and tales. And some people may not even think that they're real, but you know, we know they are. So what are the Defiers up to? Well, you'll find out what the Defiers are up to. I don't want to say too much because I think it might ruin some stuff coming up.
So his follow-up is, what are the Defiers up to during this whole Riot Quest thing? We've seen Wendell wrangling gremlins, and I'm excited for the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. But will I see a well-caffeinated dreamer or a king of nothing but trouble?
So for people that aren't familiar with what he's saying, Riot Quest is a divergent timeline. It is a split, like a timeline split at some point. The War Machine of Hordes canon, as we know it, the far more serious one that you can read about, like in the Hinchhold Scrolls and in the Oblivion book, is the war against the Infernals, which we don't know how has been resolved. We don't know how the Infernals are beaten, if they're beaten, what all happens. That's ongoing and will continue to go on through, you know, the upcoming War Machine of Hordes releases and as we move forward. It's just the current plot point, right? Riot Quest is the timeline where the fight's over and the Infernals won. So Kane has been reduced to just smoldering ruins, and the luckiest, toughest, and smartest individuals survived, and they've basically been left behind. The Infernals took everyone else, claimed their souls, and left. They're gone. So you have all these people running around this apocalypse, and they've got, you know, great vaults full of treasure and old castles full of weapons and stuff, but there's no one left to guard them. So everyone's just running around grabbing whatever they can. And it's a little bit, you know, a little bit in the future, because if you notice in Riot Quest, the tech is a little bit further than it is currently in War Machine and Horde. So people have been like putting different things together and building different gear to survive. So in that timeline, what the Grimkin are doing is having the time of their lives. The souls that they wanted are gone. They got a bunch, though. They were able to steal away. And so most of the Grimkin have returned back to Urkane, but some of them have remained on Kane. And those that are, it's the apocalypse, and they're just partying. They're partying like it's 1999. They're just having the time of their life. It's mostly gremlins running around just being complete jackasses. So Wendell is your stereotypical, like, nerdy collector. Like, somebody who would be really, 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 really too much into butterfly collecting. But he collects Grimkin. He collects gremlins specifically, and he's always trying to find different ones, like maybe a slight color variation, or one's got a spot, or one's missing a tooth. And he runs around just trying to get them, because there's so many running around just causing mayhem and havoc. The four horsemans are the four horsemans of the apocalypse. They're basically like sadistic little children that are playing dress up and are running around just partying and having a good time, but at everyone else's expense. Like running into them is not a pleasant experience. You're probably going to lose a limb or something else. When people hire them for their crews in Riot Quest, they're not really hiring them in the traditional sense. When you think of a heist as like, you're the getaway driver, or you're going to be, you know, the front man. They sort of just lure them in and then point them in the direction of the enemy and let the enemy deal with the problem of those four while they go in and do whatever they need to do.
I still want some more Defiers. I want new casters for Grimkin.
You know, it's not impossible, but it's hard. And here's why. The Defiers are very specific, right? Yeah. I mean, obviously you are the lore master, so you're well acquainted with how they came to be. Mm-hmm. But those were specific individuals cast into Urkane by Menoth for defying him in the beginning, where they basically spent their equivalent of, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. Time is sort of irrelevant to them in Urkane being twisted into what they've become. So the idea of a new Defier would have to be more like an unknown Defier, like one of them nobody knew about. But that's kind of a massive retcon to come up and be like, oh, and by the way, there was also, you know, the Larson, and no one knew about the Larson, and he didn't join up. I think it's more
This sounds very plausible.
It is plausible, but I think it's more likely to see either an epic version of an existing Defier, or I think it is possible to see a Grimkin warlock who is not necessarily a Defier. And there's a lot of different ways that could be done. Somebody who has found a way to manipulate their nightmares, which is what the Warbeasts are their nightmares, and a way to tap into them that maybe the Defiers are willing to share some amount of their power with. But I think writing in a brand new Defier, I'm not going to say never, but, you know, I think it's a little bit less likely.
Okay. So the next question we have from Joji, he says, does development like what they're seeing from the Champions format? What does development want the format to grow into?
Part one of that. Champions is interesting. And the people that buy into the format and enjoy playing it and enjoy the list building puzzles around it seem to have a very good time. And that's what we want. you know, we don't create formats arbitrarily. We create them to offer, the reason different formats exist is to have different experiences within the same subset of the same game. And you want people to enjoy them all equally, but some people will enjoy different ones, right? Not everyone wants to play narratively. Not everyone wants to play casually. Not everyone wants to play competitively. So the people that enjoy Champions are enjoying it. But is it where we want to be in game? No. You know, ultimately, what I would love to see is a true limited format for War Machine. What I mean by that is, like, here is the exact models and whatever, you know, not just casters, but, you know, the subset of models available to your faction that you are allowed to play. And then you would still have Legacy, you know, Masters, whatever we end up calling, which is take everything. That has some really interesting problems with it. So, you know, the idea of Standard and Legacy is obviously introduced by Magic the Gathering and other card games. We see it happen in Hearthstone and pretty much any game that gets a large library of options a player can use, which is typically collectible card games. You have to introduce it eventually because the sheer volume of options is overwhelming for the new player. War Machine has definitely got a ton of options at this point. Unlike card games, though, switching over to Standard, as it was, is a matter of acquiring the cards. You just have to get them, whether you buy them, trade for them, however you acquire them, you're just getting them. And once you have all your cards collected, you put them together and you're good to go. War Machine, as a miniatures game, is more than that, right? And it's that difference that causes the problem. Because it's not just buying the miniature. It's not just finding the miniature. It's assembling it and, in many cases, painting it. So you have a time investment with each playing piece in a miniature game that you don't have. A time investment of preparation that you don't necessarily get in other games. So the second you tell players, this is the format. Like, this is going to be the big deal. But by the way, those models you've had for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, you can't play with those to play in this. People immediately back out, right? They don't want to hear that. They want to be able to use the thing that they spend this amount of time and investment in. So how do you overcome that? Traditionally, in a lot of games, the way you overcome that is you make the support and the prizes for the limited format very strong. And in often cases, it's cash prizes. But you cannot do cash prizes in a miniatures game. It's a terrible idea. This is a game where a shaky hand, someone sneezes, somebody bumps the table, a die hits a model. There's too much room for human error. And say we did a War Machine tournament and $10,000 was on the line. And somebody's hand accidentally slipped and they nudged a model 0.8 inch forward. There'd be fist fights. Like, a lot of people would handle it great and professionally, but when money's on the line, some people don't. You know, some people, you see what happens with like poker and other gambling. Like, some people, it's a big deal. And any perceived cheating, even if it was accidental, becomes a really big problem. And we don't want that to happen. So is Champions where we want it ultimately? If I had a genie and I could wish, no, it's not. You know, it's not limited enough. I think there's steps we can get to be there. But part of the silver bullet we're trying to figure out is how you get people to buy in when part of that format is telling them they're not allowed to use all the things they've spent the time and effort into collecting without offering a prize that could be as volatile as cash prizes. It's a tricky puzzle.
I will say that I agree with you. But that's why you get paid the big bucks, because you get to solve these intractable problems with no problem.
Yeah. It's a rough one, and it'll be ongoing. It'll be tweaked and it'll be worked on. And my hope is that it gets there.
Okay. So let's go ahead and go to the next one.
Let's do that.
This is also from Joe G. He says, additional question for Hungerford.
Okay.
War beasts in many fashions seem overly costed when compared with Grimkin beast output and versus Jack output. Is this something design is aware of, and are there ways to address this outside of dynamic updates?
Well, I don't agree that all beasts are overcosted, I think, compared to those two. In some cases, there are definitely some that are a little bit more than they should be, some that are cheaper than they should be. And the way that these will be addressed is the dynamic updates. Definitely. I think we saw that most recently with the Krill Company one, where, you know, the bomber came down from 19 to 17. Little changes like that. In many cases, beasts are operating as intended in terms of what they're, if they didn't have a point cost, if they were just the rules on the card. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And it's sometimes one or two points. Sometimes it's more, right? Sometimes it's Sea King levels where it needs a more significant drop. I don't think we have any that are really outstanding as much as the Sea King was, which he came down from what, 42 to 38 was the update for him, if I remember.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. It's been a while.
It was a lot.
But are we?
I don't know if I ever told you this, but that was literally the product release that crushed my spirit with Troll Bloods and got me to switch Fashions.
I'm gonna get you back one day, Jay.
It's true. I still have a love in my heart for trolls.
The question is, are we aware of it? Yes. So one of the things I do as lead is try to pay attention to basically everything. That's why I'm in every War Machine Awards Facebook group, even like a lot of the individual ones for, you know, small cities and big cities, and talk to everyone I can as much as I can and try to keep my finger on the pulse of just what's going on, but also have to filter all the information because a lot of people can provide really constructive, great feedback, and some people get beaten by something and they don't like that they got beaten by something and they think that that thing needs to get worse so that they can beat it. And part of the trick is differentiating between the two types of feedback. We watch not just competitive results, casual results, things that people enjoy but find too complicated to use, things that aren't fun. The trickier part is that we're very far in the addition now. And there's only so many changes that you can make. It's, you know, when CID was in its sort of prime. And when I say that, I mean, like, there were CIDs happening every 2 or 3 months. A lot of changes happened rapid fire, but there was a massive, downside to that, which was new players couldn't keep up. Hell, a lot of intermediate players couldn't keep up. It was rules changing so fast and everything was in so much flux that a lot of people just were like, I can't keep up with this. I'm just going to play with it how it is and deal with it then. Or they played casually with their friends and said, I'm not going to try and keep up with the tournament meta. And that's a bad thing, right? When people feel intimidated by the amount of changes. So that means the changes needed to slow down for a variety of reasons. So are there more things I would like to drop points on than you will see happen in, say, 2020? Yeah, that's there. Absolutely. But there's only so much testing time and there's only so much that can be done at a time. At this point in the game, especially post-Oblivion, where we just redid all the theme forces, the time for major shakeups, massive, massive shakeups, is kind of coming to an end. Like, the game needs to be able to settle and let the meta rotate on its own. And I think we're starting to see some of that, which is good, which is healthy. But obviously, dynamic updates do still need to occur. It's just, I know for some people it's jarring how fast they went to how slow they went, but I think it'll all equal out in the end.
So one of the things I pulled from that was Mark IV imminent and confirmed. Is that correct?
That would have been the wrong thing to ascertain.
I can't even imagine. Like, you would have to have, I think, a time machine or something to give you basically double the hours in the day for you to, at this point, do the work necessary to prep a Mark IV.
I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible by any means, but it would take a lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
Okay, next question is from Grey Lord Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Says, some factions have been waiting quite some time for a new caster. When can we expect the next new caster for each faction?
When they arrive. That's a hard question to answer because you got Riot Quest feeding in new models. And a lot of those models are built for Riot Quest first, and then, you know, make sense as a caster second. And then we've actually got the planned out War Machine Horde specific casters that are coming that are part of the Infernal Invasion storyline, which 2020, you're going to see some of the Hordes ones. So it's hard to answer, because some factions may not see a new caster for quite some time. Some factions may not see a caster in 2020. I mean, I can guarantee you some factions will not see new caster in 2020, whereas some might see multiples. It depends. And honestly, earlier in War Machine, there was the sense of parity with the, and I say parity, P-A-R, not I-T-Y, not parody, like satire. A sense of parity with the releases of the anthology books, right?
Right. Where
everybody got the same sort of stuff at the same time. But at this point, every faction has so many options and so many casters and so many different things that that doesn't really need to exist anymore. You know, a lot of factions have like 12 to 15 casters. A 16th one? Is it really necessary versus some other things? Not necessarily. So if it's the right thing for the story and it's the right thing that maybe the faction just needs, you might see it happen. But that won't always be a caster.
Okay. So the next question we have again from Hybrid Monkey D.
Mm.
He says, I've been seeing a rise of desire for a Trollbloods / Signar cross-faction theme force.
What?
Any comments on its possibility or hints towards the next cross-faction theme? I'd love to see what a theme force that arcs over the War Machine / Horde divide would look like.
We'll tell you that in 2020, of the new themes being released, none of them are crossed between Hordes and War Machine. Trolls are going to be a big part of things, but War Machine saw, we saw Strange Bedfellows and Warriors of the Old Faith, things like that. You're not going to see as much of that for Hordes. In some places, it just didn't make as much sense and it wasn't necessary. And there were more things we wanted to add and themes for more specific factions that we wanted to do in a different way. So I know some people were fans of the cross theme that you saw and kind of come out initially in Oblivion and Strange Bedfellows. Some people hate them. I will tell you that you will not see more than one in 2020 for Hordes. And the one you see makes a lot of sense. It's not going to be something super weird. Like some people will talk about like Legion and Retribution, you know, like the elf crossover. And I think this is one that when people see the theme force, they're going to be like, no, okay, that's completely logical. Like, these are two groups I could totally see teaming up to try and deal with Infernals.
Okay. Next question.
Yes. Next question for you. Did you see episode 9?
I have, twice.
What'd you think? We were talking about it Warfare Weekend, about how excited we were to see it.
Yeah. So I did enjoy it a lot. But I'm also, like, I'll enjoy almost any Star Wars movie.
I'm the same.
There were a few things that I kind of quibbled on that I could have wished they would have done a little bit different, but I don't know that I'm necessarily one of the like JJ truther release the final cut people at this point.
Yeah, I've been seeing that. I went and saw it. I had fun. You know, I saw it with my family while I was down the bayou for the holidays. My sister was sitting two seats over from me and watching her. She's 30 and she was just jumping up and down. She's like the perfect like YouTube reactor, even though she doesn't do that. Like she just everything that happened, like she'd cover her mouth, her eyes would go wide, she'd cheer, she would, you know, and she's normally a very like quiet, reserved person, unlike me. And so during the movie theater, I'm dead silent. I'm just zoned in on the movie and she's just into it. We had a great time. I loved it. And The Mandalorian. Come on, man. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's a great time to be a Star Wars fan.
It was one of the first show that I went to was Friday night. And, you know, the theater's packed, release night. And I love going to Star Wars movies on releases because it just has like a special energy.
Oh, yeah.
And like there were multiple points where like the crowd erupted in cheers during the movie. And so that's something that I think is cool.
I agree. Okay, back to the War Machine questions.
Okay. Excuse me. So this is from Andy Son. He says, can you comment on the size and complexity of the game of War Machine and the effect this has on increasing barrier of entry for new players to the game? Are there any plans for new / revamp formats to make the game more accessible to newer players?
I think we kind of hit on this a little bit earlier during the champions talk. You know, the game is big. It has a lot of options. It has a ton of options. And you definitely, when you come into War Machine these days, you have to take one of two approaches, in my opinion. Either I'm just going to play this game casually. I'm going to play with my friends and we're going to grab the models we like. We're going to build our forces and we're going to learn together, but we're going to learn what our armies do. This is the way I play a lot of games with my friends, you know, that are War Machine. We're just going to, you know, we look at each other's stuff and see what each other's specific things that we've bought do. And then we learn our own microcosm of a meta, which is a great way to approach any sort of game you play. Or I'm going to try and play this competitively, in which case you are opening yourself up to the wide world of War Machine. there is definitely a learning curve to do that because of the sheer amount of things. And the talk about champions and the need for a true limited format in the future speaks to that. It's something that's very much on my mind and ways to accomplish it because that barrier can be daunting for some. They're all in and want to, and the War Machine definitely has its place in terms of competitiveness and crunch. And some people love that, but for some people it can be intimidating. And we definitely want to make it less intimidating. So I think some things like champions will help. But in general, when we look at the Oblivion campaign that got released, which the people that have been playing that typically we've been getting very good feedback on that one, that was built for everyone else, right? That was built for the people that them and their friends own an army or two, maybe they're just starting out and they wanted a way to play in a sort of organized way together. And stuff like the Oblivion campaign and future campaigns we'll be releasing for it are definitely aimed at that audience. And for people that follow a lot of podcasts and blogs and talk online, there's definitely a view of the game having an almost exclusively competitive following. But I can tell you that's just not the case. Like, definitely we have a lot of competitive players and we have a lot of competitive minded players, but we have a lot of people that just don't go to the local store and they don't talk about things on Facebook and they don't listen to podcasts. They go and they buy their stuff or they order it somewhere and then them and their friends play, you know, it's like D&D, right? They just play every week or whenever. And we are catering to them as much as we are catering to the competitors and making sure everyone's got one. Actually, to be honest, we probably cater to the casual more than the competitive. I had a retailer recently reach out to me and he said, could you send me the PDFs of all the organized play, every league, every casual event for Mark III? So I sent him the handful of steamrollers and then I sent him the 20 some odd PDFs that were just all casual play. And it was kind of the comment to like, yeah, there's way more casual play than there is than competitive War Machine. So
the follow-up question for this from No Howard, I think is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. He says, in addition to the complexity of the game, the number of models in line, etc., the gap from Battle Box to Journeyman League to First Tournament is a huge in my experience. Mm-hmm. Can Hungerford share his thoughts on both getting new players interested as well as sustaining their interest? What efforts has he seen been successful from the community, and what role can/should organized play have in this equation?
Sure, absolutely. So there's a ton of organized play for whatever somebody wants. Here's the big thing these days. There's almost, depending on your community, a forced pace that you are expected to enter the game into, depending on who you talk to. And that can be the biggest tournament. If someone shows up and they go to a store and the store only does steamroller, they only do 75 point steamroller, and that's the only way that anybody plays the game, and anything else in their minds is a complete waste of time. And somebody shows up and is trying to get into, you're forcing them into the deep end, and that will turn people away. Some people it will attract, and in many others it'll turn away. As someone introducing someone in the community, what you have to do is gauge the pace they want to take things at. Like I said, a lot of people play games just with their friends at their own pace, building up their collection, whether this is a card game or, you know, a miniatures game. You know, like you get into Magic, you and your buddies who have never played Magic before, and you all start playing. You each get, you know, some booster packs and you get four decks. It's not like everyone's going to go immediately just go net list the absolute best one and drop $1,000. Somebody might. And if they do, they're already creating sort of that schism where they show up with this super tuned deck where everyone else maybe says has, you know, entry level decks. And War Machine can feel like that for a new player sometimes, where they're just at their entry level and they're playing these super tuned things that are, they have a lot of combinations and interactions and they're trying to learn how to do a throw. Meanwhile, someone's pulling off, you know, like a waterfalling on a unit or, you know, multi-layered combos and all of a sudden someone's dead. So pacing, find out their comfort level, how quickly they learn, what they want out of the game. And then between all the organized play that's available for free through the Oblivion campaign and then through Steamroller and Journeyman, you have a ton of options to either use verbatim as they're written or just pick and choose your favorite parts and use those to run something that caters to the people that are playing it.
All right. Well, I guess one follow-up question. Do you have any other, I guess, tips or advice that you'd just like to throw out there about community building for people in general beyond that?
Be nice. You have to be an extrovert. When I was a press ganger before I adjourned, anybody who knows me knows I'm like a hyper extrovert. I just love people and love talking to people and being in giant social groups. You have to be welcoming, but you also have to be able to read people. And it can be a delicate balance, because people want different things, but you have to be welcoming. You want to treat someone like you want to be treated. When somebody joins a group, they may not know any of you. It's like walking into a well-established group of friends and then all of a sudden being like, hi, I'm the new guy or girl. There's a lot of anxiety involved in that. And some people will never make that jump unless someone is there to help them in, right? It's like the old people outside the carnival tents yelling out, hey, come one, come all. You have to be warm and inviting. And then when they get there, this goes back to the pacing thing I was saying. You can't get them in and then go, and now here's exactly what you're going to do. If they go, I don't want to do that. And all of you go, well, that's the way it is. Well, you just wasted your time and theirs. Be warm, be welcoming, be inviting, be nice. And then when they get there, you know, have an open conversation with what they're looking for. Most of all, be patient. At narrative events we run at Gen Con and Lock and Load, we've had people play in the big 16-player 8v8 mega battles. That was their second game of War Machine ever. And they were playing 50-point armies in an 8v8, you know, giant chaotic thing. And they had the time of their lives, and that's because we had a talk with them, and all the players had to talk with them ahead of time, and we made sure that not only their other teammates, but the opponents across the table from them helped them and encouraged them and gave, you know, like helped them move models and reminded them of little things. Be that person, right? Like baby steps.
All right. So our next question is from Seth By. He says, is there any chance of a new type of terrain being released for War Machine?
Yes. Yes, there is.
And would you like to expound any on that?
So no, I'm not saying it will happen. I'm not saying it will happen, but I could see Steamroller introducing Steamroller annual terrain types. The problem, the reason that I'm not saying that will happen, is to do so requires people to make it. And that's a big thing to do, especially if we say it's annual. That's a big problem. Right. So then it becomes, should it be permanent? And how do you introduce that? You can't just drop it out of nowhere. There probably needs to go in some kind of, you know, rule book or product. We just redid the rule book with Remix. So let me just say there's some logistical issues that have to get solved before it becomes a commonplace thing. But I think the game could benefit from new types. Simple ones. Nothing too over the top. You know, nothing like where if you were on it, you could see some models if they weren't within an inch or a certain size, and then other models could see you. It would, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
And nothing that your model would fall off of or anything like that.
Right. We'll have this be the last question for this episode.
Ooh, for the general public?
Yes. So, Joji says, is the real reason for the removal of hills so that development can no longer say random shots are fun, stuff like the hills, they are going to die.
The real reason for the removal of hills is that Jason Watt bet me that I wouldn't remove hills, and he said he promised me a steak dinner, and I like steak.
Okay, well, that's fair enough.
No. I figure a question that loaded, I'll give an answer to that one.
All right. Well, William, thank you very much for being on this episode. We appreciate it.
Oh, of course. And we're about to roll right into the bonus episode, right?
We are, yeah. So
is this the meta after dark?
Sure.
So what you're saying is if people want to hear the spicier questions I'm no doubt about to get asked, they need to sign up as a Patreon to be able to listen to the extra episode.
Yes, that's correct. Yep. Oh. So thank you to our patrons who back us on Patreon. You guys are awesome. And check out stuff from discountgamesinc.com. And you can also find sweet gaming items from Muzon Minis, where we just sell awesome stuff.
Yes. Also, play War Machine and Hordes, Monsterpocalypse, Riot Quest, and look for more information about Warcaster very soon. Also, have a good day.
Also, have a good day.